years, more than that. And today, 9 out of 10 Zionists are Christians.
Yeah.
John Hagee, for example, one of the leaders of the Christian Zionist movement in the States, said, imagine 50 million evangelical Christians in America joining in common cause with 5 million Jewish people in America. It's a match made in heaven. Mm. He's put that 10 to 1. So you've got that heavy emphasis of what is now American foreign policy rather than British foreign policy to maintain a presence in the Middle East through the Israeli state.
And what's interesting is, you know, actually, perhaps both sides aren't very complementary of each other, because from what I understand, those evangelical elements believe that, you know, Jews must be forcibly converted at the end of times, and, you know, the Talmud has less than complimentary words about Jesus and Christians, for example. But there seems to be this marriage of convenience at the moment between these two sides. And also, it's interesting you mentioned the British state, because, of course, they promised the homeland. But then there was this campaign of terrorism by groups like the Haganah and the Stern Gang and the Ergun, who attacked British politicians and statesmen and the King David Hotel on that road to getting their independence from Britain. So just interesting that whilst we see this philo-Semitism, actually under the surface, there's been a lot of violence, particularly from the Zionist movement. Sayed Ammar, if I could come back to you. And we saw earlier, of course, Muslims in London. They are clearly aware of the disguise, if you will, being used by these normalisation projects. But what role do collaborators in the Muslim and Christian community, for that matter, play in terms of how they enable this agenda?
Well, the role of collaborators is absolutely vital, not just in faith washing, but also more broadly in terms of furthering the interests of nefarious actors, be it, you know, Islamophobes within the British state or elsewhere. Without those sort of collaborators, the sort of good face, if you like, of this activity, there wouldn't be the depth of infiltration within our mosques and our churches. And that's principally because the people who are allowing them into these spaces are the people very often who are leaders in our community, people who are trustees of different buildings and centers. And so it's them who are principally responsible for allowing these Zionist actors into our spaces, and also promoting it within, you know, the Muslim community as something harmless. And actually, I have to say, I think that it's largely a case of naivety than it is of malice, because I think when Muslims and Christians, who by and large are very, you know, peace-loving people, who love their, you know, brothers in faith in terms of the Abrahamic faiths, when they see this issue of interfaith, they think, well, of course, we, you know, have lots of common ground, we are monotheistic, we have, you know, we believe in many of the same scriptures and prophets. So why wouldn't we try to have a dialogue to engage and get to know each other better and work on various issues that are of mutual interest? For example, when it comes to Muslims and Jews in particular, issues around burial rights are very important. It's important for Jews and Muslims in local areas to, you know, have a dialogue when it comes to their councils in terms of arranging those issues to do with funerals, for example. They see this and think, well, why wouldn't we be involved? But there is a lack of curiosity and, as I say, a naivety about some of the broader aims being pushed. And of course, there are those people who we shouldn't give the benefit of doubt to, who, you know, have been very active in this interfaith peace washing and faith washing industry for a long time, you know exactly what they're doing. So those actors are completely critical in terms of giving the Zionist movement the depth that they have within our Muslim and Christian communities across the world, but, you know, particularly in Britain and the United States.
And Ammar, if I could just stay with you as well. Due to the environment of hate and pressure that we're seeing placed on the Muslim community, they're guilt-tripped sometimes into participating in normalisation projects, maybe to prove their innocence and to prove they aren't anti-Semitic. How do you advise Muslims, and indeed, again, Christians, to proceed when faced with these types of infiltration attempts and these pressure attempts in our communities?
Well, I think I can only really speak on in terms of Muslims, because I think we have there are some particular issues with our community, which is that by and large, the Muslim community is made up of immigrants and descendants of immigrants in Britain. Of course, there are many people who converted to Islam, but principally, you know, say comes from a population that doesn't originate, you know, from Britain, as it were, at least in sort of the last sort of 60, 70 years. And so there are multiple issues at play. There is, for some people, there is an issue of thinking of being sort of grateful guests, if you like. I like this term, grateful guest syndrome. They think that they don't really have any power or agency in Britain. And so they are at the behest of the British state and all of these various interests. And if they don't accommodate them in some way, then, you know, they could end up being deported. They could have issues in terms of their, you know, immigration status. They could be put on lists. They could be targeted in some way. So that's an issue that I think is particular to the Muslim community more than it is to the Christian community. But also, I think it's a lack of confidence in one's own convictions, because if you are catching wind to the idea that basically this is being used to sort of leverage Zionist interests within the Muslim community, and you don't do anything about that because you're scared of potentially the charity commission is going to come after you, maybe you're not going to get funding from, you know, the Home Office or something like that, and so you end up compromising on your religious ideals to promote that, then that's really a question of a lack of religious conviction, and indeed of, in some ways, you know, it might be considered by some to be a strong language, but I think it's absolutely appropriate. It's kind of a treachery to your own values, never mind to your fellow, you know, community members.
Yeah, absolutely. And Reverend, if I could ask you the same type of question, what advice would you have to people who are faced with, I mean, you've come under immense pressure and kind of campaigns by Zionist organisations. What advice would you have to others in terms of standing strong, if you will?
Find out more. Reach out. If you're breaking your Ramadan fast, invite neighbours, Christians, Jews, to join you. Find out who they are, what you have in common as parents, as grandparents, as in your communities. Reach out and find out more about anti-Zionist Jewish organisations, for example, the Jewish Network for Palestine or the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, to Jewish organisations I'm involved with. The Convivencia Alliance brings together three faith communities to work for justice and peace in Palestine, or from the Palestinian Christian perspective, organisations like Sabil or Kairos, because people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Mm. And we have so much in common that is far more than the things on which we differ. We are stronger together, and that's why I would encourage those listening our program to engage in interfaith dialogue. You have nothing to lose, so much to gain.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your wonderful insights, Reverend. And, of course, as well to you, Brother Sayyid Ammar Kazmi. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. And I'd like to also thank you at home. You can join us again next week for another edition. Assalamu alaikum.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم our greetings and salams and respect and salutations, first of all, to the Imam of our time, Imam Mahdi, Ajjalallah Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif, and to you, dear brothers and sisters, who are listening to another episode of the program, Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to delve a little bit deeper into challenges and problems that you, dear parents, Muslim parents, might have with regards to raising your lovely, dear teenagers. And alhamdulillah, in the studio, we have our dear guest, an expert of the program, Sayyid Salman Naghawi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University. His specialty is Islamic studies. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much.
So previously, we mentioned some very beautiful points with regards to the roots of the problem of having a troublesome teenager, a very tough teenager who doesn't listen to you, who's very rude, who displays a lot of negative behavior. And we talked about the fact that there needs to be rules, needs to be set by the father. He's the, as they say, the boss of the family. And we talked about the fact that the parent, meaning the mother and the father, need to educate themselves with regards to the management of their own behavior long before even the conception of their child, even prior to marriage. And all marriages have to take place based on the fact that there has to be a mutual understanding, the establishment of a very safe and sound unit between the husband and the wife. And what do you have for us today?
Yes, we need to emphasize the fact that we should do all of this again because we love them. They should understand that.
Uh-huh. We should be there always. So we should do it how?
For example, we need to remain very calm, cool, and show our love, stand behind them, kiss them, take their hands in our hands, press them, show your love for them, show your concern for them. Even if the child is rude, even if he is rude, then you should try to keep your calm. Because if you don't, they're testing you. They're testing you. They're trying to push you back.
They want to see where your weak point is. So next time that they want something from you, they're going to squeeze that button.
Exactly.
And it's going to work.
Exactly. And if you show your anger, if you become, you know, you start yelling at them, and then you want to say to them, don't yell at me. Don't yell at your friend. You don't yell at your brother or sister. They'll come back and say, you also yell. You also yelled at me. So you give them an excuse for that bad behavior. So you need to be, as I said, remember that they will always try to push you back. They will also try to say, look, no, they start to grumble and try to annoy you. But you need to remain patient.
This is the hard part.
Very hard part.
I mean, this is a jihad. This is the major jihad with your nafs, where you get so enraged and you want to just start shouting and yelling and, you know, but that's like when you have to really struggle with yourself.
Exactly. The moment you do that, you will, your child will know that you can be overpowered, you can be taken care of, you can be, you know, knocked down whenever he or she wants to. So.
And that comes from a healthy mind and a healthy body. So again, your health, your mental health equals the mental health of your teenager, right?
Yes. So you need to, you have to show more mature behavior. You need to show that you're not coming down and stooping.
To their same level.
Same level. You need to show that you are in command, you are in control of yourself. And it's for their sake that you're doing it. And you need them, and you should also realize that, as we said, they have problems within. It's not the case.
Your hormones are not. Don't have any problems.
Yes.
If they're safe and sound, pay attention to your child's hormones.
So you need to be able to control yourself, and that's very difficult, especially in the face of rude behavior. In the face of behavior that the child is trying to make you angry.
Right.
and trying to tease you. He's trying to, you know, push the boundaries, and you
a little need, bit further to yes. see how further they can go. Yes. Let's go for a short break, and we'll be right back.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. So we're talking about troublesome teenagers, that it's really hard to manage them, and you lose your patience, and you want to yell, and you become outrageous. So Sayed just mentioned that sometimes your children are trying to test you, and they just want to find out how further ahead they can go to see the boundaries, right? So at that point, you just have to make sure that you keep your calm, keep your cool. And this, we said, was the most difficult thing, but...
You need to practice that also. I mean, normally you should keep some time for your... When you go for your self-evaluation, you need to remember what happened. If you were facing a difficult situation, for example, you should picture yourself... As a nurse who has a difficult patient to deal with, how are you going to deal with that difficult patient? And then you need to, you know, make some mind games in yourself and to find out how the different ways to tackle that situation. So it should be a part of our evaluation process that we should be carrying out, of course, as every believer, every competent person should be doing so, as we said,
muhasabu
qablan tuhasabu,
right. Well, yeah, that's like the most difficult thing to do. But one thing that I have experienced myself with my own daughter is that when I lose my anger, when I lose my patience and I do become angry, when she's angry and we fight together, then I feel so negative and so guilty afterwards, and I keep condemning myself. Oh, why did you do that? Why didn't you, stay calm? And the times that I do control myself in the moment that I want to, like, say something or do something, then 10 minutes or 20 minutes after, or, 5 hours later, I look back at the situation and I'm so proud of myself. I'm like, well done.
Yes, you reward yourself, and if you have been successful, then you should reward yourself. You should thank Allah Almighty for being able to meet the challenge. And if unfortunately you have not been able to meet that standard, then you should reflect on what was the thing that you should have done, or what was the reason that you did that, and then you will come back the other day, the next day, and you will start again. So you need to chart your progress also. You need to understand that maybe the first time you tried, you failed. No problem. Let me try again. Don't lose hope. And that is very important in this situation, because any person who wants to become a model for others, wants to mentor others, wants to become a leader for others, then he or she has to practice that.
This is a very beautiful point that you mentioned, that to... keep track of your own achievement. CBT psychologists these days, when you refer to them with a problem, they tell you to fill out a chart of your motives. First of all, the situation, the motive, the feeling, and the behavior. And, it helps you to understand deeply and to analyze your own behavior, so that when similar situations arise, you know how to act in a different way. Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back, you brothers and sisters. We're talking about tough children, tough teenagers, and how you as the parent need to behave by, first of all, remaining calm and keeping track of your own achievements in your reaction to the bad behavior of your teenager. What else?
And then you need to be able to, as we mentioned, maintain that communication, assertive communication. You need to, if there's an emotional situation, there's a difficult situation, you need to stand away and remove yourself from that situation. Instead of, you know, going after the person and yelling at him or scolding him or whatever, that's not going to lead you anywhere. That the entanglement will become more severe.
So you can leave the house, for example.
Leave the house, leave the room, go to the bathroom, wash your face.
Take a shower.
Take a shower, whatever. And then come back to a better situation where you can be deal in a productive way instead of a conflict, an argument, a conflict. No, that would be destructive. That will break down the relationship in any case. So you need to stand back and reflect what's happened. If you're feeling upset, go and calm down yourself. As you said, sit down, stand up, because it has been mentioned in the narratives also that if you're standing up, then you should sit down.
Change your position.
Change your position.
Drink a glass of water. Change the room, the atmosphere that you are in. Do you recommend referring to a psychologist?
Yes.
Or is this something that's like it's a Western idea?
Going to a psychologist?
Yeah.
No, we always need help. We need advice. We need insight. Sometimes we can, of course, Allah Almighty has given us the faculty for thinking and reasoning. Many things, if we reflect on them, we are ourselves able to understand the situation better than even a counselor or psychologist. But still, seeking the help of a person who knows is always advisable. فَسَلُوا أَهْلَ ذِكْرٍ كُنْتُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ. That's a general law. It's not just for the matter of taqleed in the fiqhi sense. It's more something in all situations where you have a person who is more learned than you in a field, then you can seek advice. There's no problem in doing that. But at the end of the day, it's you who's going to implement it. It's you who have... The psychologist will give you many, many solutions or many, you know, remedies or many ways, but it is at the end of the day, you're going to implement them.
Right. Oftentimes, the psychologist opens your eyes to the reality or to analyzes the situation for you and cuts down the involved element, so you can see a better, more clear picture, and that would help you to manage your own behavior, understand the scenario, the situation that you are in, and react in a better way. There is so much more to talk about. But I think we have run out of time. Inshallah, we will address more of your questions and concern in our future episodes of the program, Islamic Upbringing. Thank you so much for listening to us and being with us up to this moment. I'm sure a lot of you have a lot of questions to ask, or you have concerns or comments with regards to our program. Feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit our social media, Instagram and Facebook, at Call of Islam Radio. And you can listen to our programs at parstoday.ir. وَآخِرُ دَعْوَانَا أَنَ الْحَمْدُ لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
كتاب الله
ما رو هدایت میکنه.
It guides us through life.
همه چیز رو تعلیم داده.
It has taught us everything.
باید آموخت. باید فهمید.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و آنگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی است.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت القرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Let's listen to the 15th verse of chapter Naml.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَوَرِثَ سُلَيْمَانُ دَاوُودَ
وقال يا أيها الناس علمنا منطق الطير وأوتينا من كل شيء إن هذا لهو الفضل المبين.
And Solomon inherited David. He said, O people, we have been taught the language of birds, and we have been given from all things. Indeed, this is evident bounty.
So as you were with us in the previous episode, we tried to explain the story of Prophet Solomon and David, the fact that Solomon inherits from David. This 15th verse of Surah An-Naml is started after mentioning the story of children of Israel and their Prophet Moses, ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi salam. So the verse, as you listen to, starts with this knowledge. وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا دَاوُودَ وَسُلَيْمَانَ عِلْمًا. Regarding this knowledge in the previous episode, we mentioned the fact that there are different possibilities and probabilities and interpretations when we look at the different verses of the Holy Quran throughout the different chapters. There are other possibilities mentioned that we went to details in the previous episode. Anyway, the words are about knowledge, power and ability and dignity, and we could infer that all those powers are actually included in the vast meaning of knowledge, if we of course consider this knowledge to be that extensive meaning. Anyway, it is interesting that the Holy Quran has begun the statement of the story of these two with the issue of merit of knowledge, which is the foundation of a righteous and powerful government. So it says, وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا دَاوُودَ وَسُلَيْمَانَ عِلْمًا. And we certainly did give David and Solomon knowledge. There are different kinds of possibilities and commentaries that I've tried very much to find out what kind of knowledge this has been that Almighty Allah has bestowed upon David and Solomon. And it is stated here ambiguously and not definitely. And as it was precisely said at the beginning of this commentary, when we started discussing this very verse, there are different many commentators having different opinions. Relying some other verses of the Holy Quran, some have actually considered it the knowledge of judgment. And some other commentators with the frame of reference to the verses under discussion, which speak of the language of birds and etc. So, it is clear that knowledge here has got a very vast and extensive meaning, which includes the knowledge of monotheism, religious belief, prophethood, religion, laws, knowledge of judgment, knowledge of government, and all kinds of knowledge and information and ability and information which have been necessary for the formation of a kind of extensive and powerful government. This is what we get. This is the gist of what we get from all different verses of the Holy Quran. And this is actually the fundamental difference between the kind of prophethood that these two prophets had against those of others. That is why we believe that the establishment of a divine government based upon justice, which is an equipped and a free government, is not possible without enjoying a complete, extensive kind of knowledge. So the Holy Quran specifies the rank of knowledge in the human society and the establishment of government as the first stone of the foundation of the building.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
فبدا وضيئا كالنجوم تألقا
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So, brothers and sisters, regarding this ilm that the beginning of this verse mentions, وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا دَاوُودُ وَسُلَيْمَانَ عِلْمًا, we are to say that this ilm is not any kind of specific knowledge that is referring to any kind of narrow field of knowledge. This knowledge must lead to a kind of vast and extensive government. So this means that this kind of knowledge must be something of a higher level, something that envelops every kind of knowledge that we mentioned, envelops every other kind of interpretation and possibility, power and potentiality and information that is mentioned in other verses of the Holy Quran. So we believe that this knowledge has got a very vast meaning that includes the knowledge of monotheism, knowledge of judgment, knowledge and information which are necessary for the creating of government or religious beliefs, etc. And next to this sentence, from the tongue of David and Solomon, it continues saying, وقال الحمد لله الذي فضلنا على كثير من عباده المؤمنين. What did these two say? They said, praise belongs to Allah, who has favored us above many of his believing servants. We have got a lot to discuss regarding the rest of the this verse, actually. So we will try to get to that later on in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets of this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
The conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we talk to one of Ireland's finest comedians, a man that has recently taken Twitter by storm, now also an author. His recent book details the horrific consequences of addiction and the redemptive process of recovery. never shying away from politics. He's been a strong advocate for Irish unification and Palestinian self-determination. Tadhg Hickey, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man, Sean. Delighted to be here.
Delighted to have you. So tell me, Tadhg, I've recently read your book, and I was bemused by some of it, so the honesty in the reading in the book. And actually, it was an amazing book, and it's great to see someone just put it out there like you did. Particularly, you're a comedian, you know, and you're not very, very funny, but also very, very profound. I really enjoyed
it. Jesus, thanks a million, man. Thank you.
And the stuff, I mean, your childhood growing up, do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, like, I'd say it was a happy childhood, you know. So, and this is the funny thing about drinking, because alcoholism is a mental illness, and that's kind of the premise of the book, I suppose. I feel like in Ireland, people think of drinking and drinkers and alcoholics as a kind of an aberration, you know, that they've done something wrong morally. But the fact is that they're sick, and I was sick. But I wasn't always sick. And I suppose that's the point of the childhood. There was moments where I felt, you know, and when I say sick, I mean you need something to treat the illness, and the illness really is kind of, for me anyway, anxiety. Uncomfortableness, I think, is I might have called it. But I wouldn't have put the term anxiety on it. But that anxiety would have come and it would have gone. You know, it wasn't something that was there all the time. It would kind of spike, and it would spike in bizarre settings. Like, I remember being a kid and playing soccer with my buddies and just this kind of sense of gloom coming over myself and feeling uncomfortable in myself. And like, it was kind of working class 80s Cork. Like, I wasn't about to go home and, you know, call a family meeting about it. We didn't talk about those kind of things. And as I say, when I was struck with a bit of anxiety, I probably thought I was mad. There was a big fear, whether it was just me or it was my community, you didn't want to be mad. You know, mad people were taken away by men in white coats and they were brought to hospital. Sometimes if your drinking got totally out of hand, you'd kind of wander in over the line into madness, like, and so-and-so, he's gone away to some place and he's kind of locked up. That's what you didn't want. And that would have been a fear of mine from a very early age, because this anxiety, I wouldn't have called it that at the time. The feeling comes up, you're kind of going, am I mad? But then it would go away again, and I'd enjoy doing the things I did, like playing football and hanging out with my mates and stuff. And as I say, I was a happy kid. I was obsessed with my dad. I used to kind of follow my dad around. He was a good bit older. I was a real afterthought in the family. I was quite young. But as I detail in the book, he was an ordinary man, but he was extraordinary to me. Like, he just seemed like he had life all figured out. Whereas I felt like I was kind of caught up in myself. I was worried how I was coming across. Did people like me? How do I get people to like me? He just seemed to be breezing through life, not worrying about any of these things. You know, he just seemed to have it figured out.
And you also noted in the book that your saviour was through acting and writing. You want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so the uncomfortableness that I had, to go back to that again, that could, you could get rid of that loads of different ways. When I was younger playing sport, I played soccer, reasonable level in Cork. I wasn't a bad soccer player, and that would often take it away. But getting involved in performing or acting a bit, normally the type of acting I tried to do involved comedy, and I suppose that was the origins of the comedy thing. Putting on voices, making funny noises, taking the piss out of people in my family, and doing impressions of them, all that kind of stuff. And when I was performing, and mostly in school and with friends and stuff, people would laugh, and that was another addiction straight away. Like, but it definitely got rid of that feeling of uncomfortableness, and it gave me a sense of that this is kind of the thing that I'm supposed to be at. And when I was doing the thing that I was supposed to be doing, I felt, and that I felt like I was enjoying it, again, just that feeling of, like, there's something up with me, I feel uncomfortable and I can't put my finger on it, just started to dissipate.
So what was the spark then that led to a career in comedy?
I think one of the first moments that I thought to myself, I would like to do comedy, was actually when I was a kid, and my sister and myself were very close, and she had a real influential role on my taste in everything. And she also had a really refined kind of sense of humour, and kind of, you know, Rick Mail and The Young Ones and all that type of kind of anarchic British comedy, which I loved. So I used to try and make her laugh, and I thought if she laughed at something that I had said, that was a good bar, you know, that I'd made my sister laugh because she was funny. And then it became a kind of a thing of, like, oh, how much can I get her to laugh? And, like, oh, she didn't like this thing. And it's like my first audience, I suppose. I was also trying to make my mother laugh and whatnot. And then I remember going to, so by secondary school, I think, you know, the feeling of starting secondary school is, I was a fat kid as well, right? I hope I can say fat. I know it's probably not the nice thing to say these days, but I am saying it about myself. And I got to school, you're fat, my hair was kind of weird, and you're just self-conscious, like, you're kind of going, how am I going to fit in here? My brothers, as I say, were tougher men, and they probably would have went straight into the kind of, like, I'll kick your head in type of thing. And I knew I didn't really have that in me, but I knew I had a sharp tongue, and I knew I could make people laugh, and I also knew I could make people a bit scared, because if they mocked you and you mocked them back and you made other people laugh more, I was aware that that was a real strong currency. So I just fell into kind of making people laugh, and no one really bullied me, and I kind of went to the top of the kind of social structure in school because I was able to look after myself with my tongue as opposed to my fists, you know. So that was the first inkling that I was kind of, that I was good at it. But then you go on this whole journey of, you know, am I going to be so cocky as to demand that people sit in a room and listen to me because I'm so funny? Like, that, for me, that's an incredibly, it's an audacious expression of self-confidence and self-belief. What I initially did, I did music, and I love music as well. I mean, that was a huge, huge passion of mine. I was in a band, and I would try and make some of the lyrics funny, and I was kind of playing the role of a comedian within a band. So I was hiding in a band as a comedian, I think. We were called Exit Pursued by a Bear.
What did you call it?
Exit Pursued by a Bear. So it's a pretentious quote from Winter's Tale. And the whole band was very pretentious, and I was the main reason for that. But that was my way of kind of doing rock comedy or rock kind of theatrics, I suppose. And then later on, when that folded, I was kind of doing bits and pieces of acting, and then an opportunity arose to start a comedy troupe. So again, it was not me on my own, it's me with two other people. So that was the kind of journey, I suppose, into comedy.
There's a film, isn't there? It's a bit like The Office, because I knew you were a fan of The Office.
Yeah.
And it's about a rock group of that kind. And I know Ricky Gervais was actually influenced, isn't it? What was the name of that film?
Oh my God, what's it called?
Call
that. Lads.
This is Spinal Tap.
Spinal Tap. Yeah, that's yeah, it. This is, yeah, Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
I actually feel, this is a weird thing to say, but I feel like I've got a bit in common with Ricky Gervais. Like, he was, like, you know, a big influence of mine. He was in a band, he studied philosophy in college, and he was, like, kind of, you know, doing his own thing, and then kind of fell into this big, massive comedy opportunity. So I always felt I'd get to a certain age, probably 40, and then these massive comedy opportunities would happen for me. Hasn't happened yet, John. Not down south, anyway. I'd probably get more work, like, in the Middle East, but anyway, that's another story.
Well, now, speaking about the Middle East and more closer to home, politics closer to home, a lot of your comedy revolves around politics. And I read somewhere that you were influenced, maybe slightly, in your politics by the Late Late Show one night. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I think it was possibly 1994, I think it was. So I was a kid. At that stage, it would have been probably 10 or 11. And just I was watching it live, I suppose, like most of Ireland watched Late Late Show at the time. And forgive me, I don't have all the members of the panel, but it was Jerry Adams was giving an interview, and it was a thing. We were watching it because Jerry Adams was going to be on. And it was a fairly apolitical house that I grew up in. You know, people probably were sympathetic to the Republican struggle, but not in any demonstrative way, really. And certainly from the media that we consumed, we kind of were to believe that Jerry Adams almost personified all the problems with the North, that almost, like, you know, every aspect of the conflict was on his shoulders, and that he bore personal responsibility for everything that had happened. I think it was the same night that Gay Byrne refused to shake his hand, and he basically sat down, and I didn't know that much about him before then, and I didn't know that much about the North either. And I think that's the key point, that, you know, when I watched that interview, I think Austin Curry was part of the panel, there was basically a lineup of people trying to take pops at him and traduce him in a variety of ways, and to pin, as I say, the whole conflict on his shoulders. And I just witnessed somebody really calmly, without any emotion whatsoever, refute every accusation that was coming to him, but more importantly, contextualised the conflict for the first time. I'd never heard that before. I hadn't heard anything about loyalist paramilitaries before. I just thought there was one. And I wasn't quite sure who they were fighting as a kid, but I just knew the IRA were fighting Britain, and that the impression I got from the mainstream media down south was that, you know, Ireland had won its independence. A few counties didn't make the grade, unfortunately, and they were kicking up all this storm and violence and murder because they were prone to murderousness. And we wish they would just stop it because they're really embarrassing us now on a kind of an international level. Now, I'm being a little bit playful when I say that, but that is roughly the sense of the North I had as a kid. So I wouldn't even say that I became like an Irish Republican watching that interview from Gerry Adams. I just became somebody that was really interested in the North. And that was the main thing for me. And because nobody had ever contextualised the conflict before, and more importantly, nobody had ever stated the important role that the South had played or not played, as whichever way you'd look at it, in creating the causes and conditions. And nobody had ever kind of detailed that before. For me, up until that moment, it was a kind of a separate thing. It was happening in a different place. It was unconnected to us. And as I say, we wish that they would just stop it. So definitely my head blew off my shoulders. I was like, okay, there's more to this than the mainstream media in the South is portraying. There's much more to this story than RTE and The Independent and The Irish Times are telling us. Because even, I mean, as a young kid, I was just interested in the news and, you know, I'd read bits and pieces of the newspaper and stuff. But there was another alternative version of this history out there was new to me.
And did that galvanise you to explore things further, just politically? I mean, did you read up more on what was happening in the North? Or?
Yeah, I mean, within a few years, I suppose, I would have been a Sinn Féin supporter, I suppose, in school. And that would have been unusual, I think, in the South in that period as well. I remember there was two lads in my in my class in secondary school, and we were both kind of interested in Sinn Féin. And we went to a Sinn Féin youth meeting. And one of the lads, Ken is his name, he had a copy of On Phoblacht, and I was reading On Phoblacht on my lunch break, and one of my teachers took me outside the door to ask me, was everything all right at home? And I think, you know, nothing that I've come across since encapsulates the complete misunderstanding of everything in the North that was going on down south at the time. And, you know, some people were doing it maliciously, you know, some people had agendas, but most people were just eating up the propaganda. And you see it today in the conflict that's going on right now in Gaza. Most people are just ordinary people going about their business. It's the people who are actually perpetrating and putting the propaganda out there. They have a responsibility. But your average person will become influenced by the propaganda that they consume. So I think most people down south just had this idea that there was just one perpetrator of violence in the North, and that Gerry Adams was a representative for them. And so he needed to be neutralised and censored, you know, and that's, I suppose, what was happening, literally.
You've mentioned Gaza there, and we'll get to that in a second. I just want to probe you more about your involvement with Irish reunification. And when I say involvement, you've been a strong advocate for reunification. Why is it important to you?
I think it's important to me because it connects directly to what I was saying earlier of growing up in a state that felt like it was completely disconnected from this other state. As soon as I started reading, I realised that that's not the case at all, and that there's a community of people in the North that don't feel disconnected. They feel the opposite. They feel like, you know, not that they feel Irish, they are Irish, and they think of themselves as part of the island of Ireland, and it would be their wish that that would be a 32-county republic. I think as you move towards breaking that sense of separation between the two, and you can do it physically. So, you know, I'm one of the few people I know in the South that goes to the North regularly, you know, and I'm not saying that in any kind of a flex. It's an embarrassing thing to say. The comedians on the scene, like Mario Rosenstock, would be a good friend of mine. I think he's amazing. And he was telling me that I think he went to Belfast for the first time a couple of years ago, and that would be typical. The man's been touring for 20 years, and he was wondering would people kind of know his stuff, whatever. And like the gig was sold out. I think he either did Ulster Hall or somewhere massive anyway. And everyone knew his stuff. Everyone had been following his stuff. And it's just typical of that sense of that kind of like spiritual, emotional, practical disconnect. I have be it in my work, in my social life, and, you know, making friends up here and stuff, that disconnect has never really been there for me. And if the disconnect isn't there, it makes no sense that they're two different states. Also, the history of Irish republicanism, I mean, if you're an Irish republican and you're an anti-imperialist, it would feel that it's the fitting thing for the destiny of the country would be to be reunited. And I would definitely make no apologies for that. It can sometimes be a slightly controversial thing to say or a slightly uncomfortable thing to say down south. And what I'm trying to do a little bit with my work is to get to the root of why anyone should be made to feel that that's uncomfortable. And I think, you know, something that we've spoken about a bit off camera, young people are amazing. Because young people are challenging that southern perspective all the time, that it's two separate states and two separate mentalities. So they're just some of the reasons why, I suppose, as an Irish Republican, shocker, I would want to see United Ireland.
You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs around Ireland. I'm joined by our special guest, comedian and author, Tadhg Hickey. Moving on to events in Gaza that we've been all horrified by this last few months. You've been a very strong advocate for Palestinian self-determination. Has that been? And we spoke earlier, you'd said you'd met many new friends in the Middle East and stuff like that. Tell us a bit about that.
I think with Palestine, and it's a little bit like with United Ireland as well, it comes back to something we touched on at the start of, like, in my drinking, I was inauthentic. You have to be inauthentic to kind of survive. You have to lie, you have to cheat, you have to let people down in order to keep doing it. And when I got sober, one thing I was very clear about for myself was to actually protect myself, to stop myself from falling into possibility of drinking again and taking drugs again, which I know will ultimately lead, if I relapse, I've no doubt that I'll die, and I don't want to die. So it's very basic with me. I have to be authentic. So if I have personal views about the conflict, and if I have personal views about my perspective on wanting a united Ireland, needless to say, a united Ireland that would be inclusive of everyone, not a narrow nationalism, I have no interest in that. If I have those views, I need to reflect those views in my work in order to be authentic. That's the way I would look at it, you know, and I hope that doesn't sound too kind of, I don't know, lavish or pretentious or whatnot, but that's the way I do think. So for instance, if I would lose some work opportunities down south for being authentic in my views, that would be that's absolutely fine collateral damage. I need to be authentic. So in the case of Palestine, I have always felt that it's actually one of the most, bizarrely, it's one of the most easy conflicts to understand, which is in direct opposition to the key Israeli claim that it's too complex for you and I to ever understand. It's just a case, it's a land grab, it's settler colonialism. And I think if I'm going to be authentic about Ireland, I need to also be authentic about Palestine and not worry too much about the backlash that you will get. Also, I have friends that are doing comedy in the States and Canada and places like that. They have backlash, like they have serious, I mean, you know, they have serious repercussions to worry about. In Ireland, it's less so. So I feel like, you know, many Arab friends have sent me messages. I mean, if you saw my messages on Instagram, like it's hard not to be crying at times, because there's people saying, you know, it's refreshing to hear someone from the West just highlight what's going on here. Like, so it's basically like Ireland on a kind of a global level for me. It's like, you know, people hating you because they don't want to have the conversation, and then people loving you because they see it's unusual for a white face to be fronting something that's talking about the decades of oppression, murder, mayhem, second-class citizenship, you name it, apartheid that they're living under. So, again, if you're going to be authentic, you accept that you're going to get some people, you know, I had a Zionist witch saying that she was putting a curse on me and all that kind of stuff. But then I had loads of Muslim friends saying that they'd undone the curse. So that was a bit of crack, like, you know. But as regards work and stuff, I made a kind of a pact with myself a long time ago that I was going to be real to me anyway. I'm not saying it's the reality. It's my belief system. And if that means that I don't get work with the BBC or RT, then so be it.
I think you're being too kind to yourself when you say, you know, you don't get it hard here as an artist when you stray off the conventions. I mean, like, we as a country steeped in censorship, I think still if you stray off those conventions that you do get it hard. And you see that particularly from establishment journalists, establishment politicians. And I think you've been the receiving end of that also.
Yeah, I suppose with journalists, they'll have jobs. Like, I don't, like, because I'm working for myself, I'm lucky. You know what I mean? Like, they'll attempt to, you know, so there's people online who've tried to get my gigs cancelled and whatnot.
Welcome to the club.
Huh?
Welcome to the club.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose that's, you know,